Monday morning. I'm Brooke Allen in for Mark Bayshore today. And our first guest keeps a very close eye on her city, Detroit, which she writes and reports about several times a week in the Detroit Free Press. Columnist Rochelle Riley has recently written about the country's extraordinary presidential campaign, the importance of the upcoming Detroit School Board election, and other important developments. And Rochelle Riley, welcome back to Current State and good morning.
Good morning.
And yesterday, you know, yesterday you wrote about Donald Trump's many harsh and outlandish comments in the presidential campaign and that it is time for the GOP to, quote, end the Donald Trump show. And what do you make of Americans who downplay these comments and continue to support him?
Well, you know, for the longest time, I wasn't writing about the presidential election. I didn't want to write when there were 16 candidates vying for the Republican nomination, and I didn't want to write about Hillary Clinton too soon because there were so many things that were unresolved. So my goal was to be balanced. And I wrote a column before this one that talked about the choice that people had to make between someone who has been dishonest in the past and someone who is dangerously cavalier. But I think now Mr. Trump has gotten to the point where it's not cavalier and it's not sarcastic. It is very dangerous. And some of the things that he's saying now has made it very clear that he apparently doesn't care about the GOP and doesn't really care about our global connection to other countries and what these things, you know, mean to people outside of the bubble that he lives in. So it was a changing of my mind because, you know, it's a presidential election and you want to follow the election, but it's no longer a presidential election. This has really become farce.
And do you say he is paying a price with many establishment Republicans and a lot of the Republicans obviously not coming out to endorse him? Governor Snyder not endorsing him, but yet Lieutenant Governor Kelly is endorsing him. So that has a lot to say, I think, and actually seems like it could split the state.
Well, I have read several stories in the past few days from folks on the campaign trail with the candidates who are talking to high-ranking Republicans who are not only not endorsing him, but distancing themselves from him and talking about what to do after he loses. I think that any of the members of the GOP who are connecting themselves to him may wind up regretting that later. It just depends on how this plays out, because even though he is saying these outlandish things, and there are things that have been discovered about his campaign and those associated with it, their ties to Russia and his call for the NRA or suggestion that the NRA could do something about Hillary Clinton appointing the wrong people to the Supreme Court, I think that in addition to distancing themselves from him, they're trying to figure out how to make sure he doesn't make it impossible to elect other Republicans across the country.
Okay, so let's assume Trump is not elected in November. What do you think the aftermath would be for the Republican Party?
Well, I think that this whole thing for Donald Trump has been about having some way to make money afterwards. I think this was all sort of a ploy to create Trump TV or Trump post the presidential campaign and that he'll do what he does. I think the GOP will be smeared by this for some time and will have to decide what it's going to be, a party for a lot of different people, a party for the people who believe in Donald Trump. I don't think there's going to be a separation of Trump fans into its own separate party, but I do know, and I've been hearing this from a lot of people, that for those people who are not interested in being Democrat or Republican, it is past time for this country to have a third political party. This two-party system has not worked for some time for a lot of people. And I think this may be the straw that finally broke that camel's back.
Okay, so what would the third party, in your opinion, offer?
Well, if they can find a way to meld their differences, it can be a place for people who are fiscal conservatives but don't want people to starve, who believe in business but don't want people to not have health insurance, and who would like to have a party that, quite frankly, isn't on the extreme. I mean, right now you've got two parties that are both just on the extremes of our political system. And why can't there be some place for people who don't believe in the democratic way of governing, which is big government and lots of taxes, still believe in the Republican Party, which doesn't believe in women's rights and, quite frankly, has become very hateful. And they would like to be counted, because right now you have a lot of little parties, and they're not going to make a difference by themselves. But if you can get a lot of those folks who are green, who are progressive, who, you know, have some similarities, and they can find a way to meld those together, and that's a large number of people. A lot of those people were in the Bernie Sanders campaign. A lot of those people were in the Green Party. I mean, even some of the libertarians, you know, some of the Republicans who left the party and became libertarian might find a way to find some commonality with some of these folks and create an actual third party.
And what do you hear Detroiters saying about the campaign?
Well, you know, Detroit is still, you know, more than 85% African-American, and there is nothing right now that the GOP is doing for African-Americans. I mean, Donald Trump not only does not reach out to African-Americans, I don't know that he talks to African-American reporters. I requested an interview and didn't even get a call back. I mean, I'm just a, you know, middle American columnist out here with regular folks who'd like to know what he thinks and what he wants to do for minorities besides ban some of them and call some of them criminals. I do think that there is a sense of disgust. There's a sense of not feeling connected to either party, which is reflected in voting. You know, we just had our last round of voting here, and the turnout was less than 15%. So the people in Detroit, a lot of Detroiters who vote, will vote Democratic because they've been Democratic, because the GOP has not been a party for African Americans for over 100 years. But I do hear from people who say they're just not happy with the choices.
And that brings us to Hillary Clinton, of course. And many Americans have serious concerns about Hillary Clinton. So what are your doubts about her suitability to be president?
Well, here's the shame of it. And President Barack Obama was not wrong when he said during the Democratic National Convention that no one is more qualified to be president than Hillary Clinton. She has been Secretary of State, a state senator, married to a president who, you know, like Nancy Reagan, was participating and was an active voice in how government was run. She knows how to do the job. But the problem is with this idea that she just is not trustworthy. And she continues to do things like that. Even, you know, at the recent convention of the National Association of Black Journalists, the National Association of Minority Journalists, which are advocacy groups that have white members, and there are plenty of white people there for anybody who thinks that this was some exclusive little club. And she was asked about the emails and once again had an opportunity to say, I made a mistake. The FBI has called me on it. Let's move on. She gave this long, convoluted answer about how she short-circuited, and the FBI did not dispute, you know, what she said. And I thought, oh, my God.
Just answer the question, right?
Well, you know, literally. So I think, you know, quite frankly, if Hillary Clinton says nothing from now until November and Donald Trump continues to say the things that he's saying, she can win in a landslide. But it's like every time she has an opportunity to give people the sense that, you know what, you may have not trusted me in the past, but you can trust me in the future, she has lost those opportunities. So it has now literally become, do you want the person that you're not sure you can always trust, or do you want someone who's going to start World War III?
So let me ask you this. You had said a few minutes ago that you had not ever heard back from Donald Trump. Have you spoken to Hillary Clinton?
Well, see, here's the thing with Hillary Clinton. We've got people who are covering Hillary Clinton, and she does talk about issues of concerns to African Americans. And since that's a part of, as a columnist, my mission is to make sure that those issues come to the fore, I don't feel the same sense of urgency about knowing what she's going to do. They're going to say the same things and do the same things that they've always done. And what we have to do is convince both of these parties that, number one, not all African-Americans are alike. Most African-Americans live in the middle class. They have the same issues and concerns as white Americans in the middle class. And those that are in poverty don't necessarily want to be in poverty. So the answer is not to keep those African-Americans in poverty. It's to find a way to change the paradigm. And I don't know that either party gets that, but she talks plenty about black folks to the reporters who do get to talk to her when she talks to them. Donald Trump has not said anything about African Americans or minorities that except what has been negative. And it would just be nice to get some sense that he knows that a third of the country, actually over 40% of the country, and you know, by the time, you know, the next two-term presidency ends, the majority of Americans will be in a minority group. So the idea that you just don't deal with that is just unbelievable.
I'm speaking to Rochelle Riley. She's a columnist for the Detroit Free Press, and we are talking about the presidential campaign and other recent topics that she has written about in her columns. And okay, Rochelle, let's shift gears for just a moment. You've written last Friday, in fact, I think, about the importance of the upcoming school board election for the Detroit Public Schools. And you wrote that, quote, "The most important job in Detroit right now is not mayor or president of the Detroit City Council. The most important job is school board member, whose sole mission is to ensure the future of Detroit," end quote. What makes school board members more important than the mayor or the president of the city council, in your opinion?
Two things. One is nothing, absolutely nothing, that Mayor Mike Duggan and the city council and all of the other leaders in the area right now are looking at or doing or trying to make work will last if they don't have leaders that they're raising to make sure that it can continue. There's nothing worse than, you know, planning a whole renaissance and putting on a whole show that will close in 2 weeks because you didn't bother to train the next actors to step in. What if Hamilton didn't have stand-ins and didn't have people, you know, ready to take the mantra and take the show on? It would close. The idea that we are still graduating kids from high school who cannot read and who go to college unable to actually participate without remedial help because they haven't been prepared, and that we can still have the kind of theft and corruption that has plagued this school district, and the idea that that's okay because we've got this other stuff going on, but then all of a sudden you don't have leaders to step up, you don't have people who are able to take on, you know, this renaissance and have it continue, that's number one. Number two, everybody in America is watching what's happening in Detroit, from the bankruptcy because many other cities are struggling and looking to see how this works, to how you educate urban children. And we have an opportunity with what's happening with this school district to show a way to do it right so that this can also happen in other places where people are plagued by the same problems. There are very few problems except sort of this incessant racism and the refusal to have public transportation that are unique just to Detroit. Every city is going through these things, and they're surrounded by suburbs who, you know, depending on who their leaders are, help or don't help. But we have got to pay attention to the fact that everything we do right now is a huge opportunity to do it with a new beginning. And if we lose that opportunity and we don't take advantage of that, shame on us.
And reportedly, there are 68 members or 68 people who are going to run for the school board. And how do you break that down as a voter?
Well, there are 68, but 10 are having their petitions canvassed, which means they may not have the signature. So that gets it down to 58. If you look at those 58 and figure out either the ones who have never done anything in a leadership role, have never participated in any way to help the schools or anyone else, you can wipe those off. And then if you look at the ones who have some type of reputation in the community, one of the most important things that the current transition manager said is that this school board needs to have people who can sort of get resources from the community, who have the wherewithal and the credibility and the respect to reach out to the business community and the philanthropic community and the religious community and say, we need your support. If they're not people who can do that, then you need to wipe those clean from the slate. By the time you get done, you're down below half of that number, and the rest of that depends on motives for running. But these are folks who you know are looking to do this because they need some type of public persona so they can run for the state legislature or run for the city council, then they need not to do that. I'm hoping that the transition manager will create a pledge that they have to sign saying, we will not run for any other office for the next 10 years after this service because this is the service that we want. Then you'll probably knock it down to about 10 and they elect 7.
So, Rochelle, let me ask you this. Have you ever thought about running for public office?
I get that question at least once a week. And while I actually think that I could do some good, I think right now my role is to keep people honest and to make sure that people are talking about the things that are important, and that's what I try to do with my column. So I'm gonna stick with that public role. The fourth estate is necessary and required more than ever, and with journalism dying, it's more important than ever for those of us who have been trained to do this and who have been doing this for a while to hold out as long as we can. But when I do read journalism, I do have to think about a way to make things work rather than just write about how they work.
Well, thank you so much, Rochelle. And, you know, real quick, I do want to ask you a pretty uplifting story that you did write about a young Detroiter who had his sights set on college but missed an important appointment and with his alarm clock, actually. Can you just tell us about that just super quick?
That is my favorite story of the year. His name is Delshawn Fowler, an 18-year-old kid, one of six children of a single mom who never went to college. He would be the first in his family to go to college and had a black college tour planned, and he was up till 2 a.m. in the morning packing and forgot to put his phone on the charger, and it died, so his alarm didn't go off. And he woke up frantic an hour and a half after the bus left to take them to The Ohio State. So he checked airplanes and bus stations and, you know, all types of schedules to see what he could do, and he finally just, you know, ordered Uber. And this amazing guy showed up and said, you want to go where? And he said, to Columbus, Ohio. He said, you do know that's in another state, right? And he told him why he was going, and that guy drove him to Ohio State. And he actually beat the bus there. And they greeted him like a rock star or a football player. And that is how we should greet academics. That is how we should treat young people who want to do what this young man wants to do. He's now in college. He's enrolled at Harris Stowe University in St. Louis. He took a 12-hour bus ride to get there. And the president of that college is a native Detroiter whose life was just like his. First in his family to go to college. People didn't expect much from him. And he is a university president who's got this kid under his wing. My favorite story of the year.
Well, and you know what? And what a great story, and just shows you how much academics can mean and how much we should support it.
Absolutely. If we did that, oh, what a difference it would make. I think that if we sort of change the way we treat people who make certain choices, we can change our choices for future leaders, for future politicians. All of that will change, and it'll make a huge difference. So I have to say, you know, two things. One is thanks to Delshawn Fowler for wanting that so badly and for, you know, being a role model for other kids. And thanks to Kevin Fuller, that Uber driver who, you know, got this, you know, order at 8 a.m. in the morning to take a kid 3.5 hours, said okay, because what you're doing is the right thing.
Exactly. And he did it. And thank you, Rochelle Riley, for being with us. Again, that's Rochelle Riley. She's a columnist for the Detroit Free Press and sharing her thoughts on the upcoming election and, of course, many elections coming up and, of course, with the Detroit School Board election as well. And of course, coming up, we do have the new report called The Contributions of New Americans in Michigan, which examines the broad and positive economic impact being made by the more than 640,000 immigrants who now call the Great Lakes State their home. We will talk about it coming up with the Office of the Michigan Office of New Americans. That is coming up straight ahead. And Flint, Michigan has a new resident. Rodney Lantine is the recently appointed CEO of the FIM, the Flint Institute of Music, which means under that FIM umbrella, Mr. Lantine also runs the Flint Symphony, the Flint School of the Performing Arts, as well as the Flint Youth Theater and Ballet. And Kern State's Jamie Paisley recently spoke with Mr. Lantine during the oh-so-busy first week heading up the FIM.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for speaking with us. And again, welcome to Michigan.
Well, thanks, Jamie. I appreciate it. And I really thank the radio station for coming down to the FIM.
Let's talk about where you're coming from, because that's out in Colorado, where you are a native, I believe, of Colorado. And you work as executive director and COO of the Museum of the Outdoor Arts, which dealt with architecture, fine arts, and dealt heavily also with kind of performing arts as well and music. Is that fair to say? This is an extension?
Yeah, that's fair to say. The Museum of Outdoor Arts was actually at three different levels. We had the performing arts. We had three theaters, the largest one being 18,000 capacity, which we did symphony summer series. We did some ballet, but traditionally it was at least 20, 25, 30 concerts of rock and roll, anywhere from Bruno Mars to country western, you know, Toby Keith, most of the major stars. We worked with Live Nation and AEG, which are two of the largest concert promoters in the world. Then we also had an art gallery, a traditional art gallery, where we had revolving gallery exhibitions. We had student engagement through education programs. And then we had an outdoor art collection. We had a multi-million dollar art collection that we spread throughout the communities, sometimes places that you wouldn't even expect to see art. It was making art a part of everyday life.
Now, I know the 18,000 seat is the Fiddler's Green amphitheater, and you said Live Nation handled a lot of that. Would you also be involved with kind of pushing any sort of fine arts or cultural music events to that space?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a something called the Scientific and Cultural Facilities District, which was a group of nonprofits in Colorado. And we utilized the amphitheater for both local events, but also for we opened up the amphitheater to all nonprofits. So we would do free events. We would do ballets. We would do local musicians, really as an outreach. So the nonprofits had the opportunity to present their performances in a large a capacity, in a large arena, and sometimes we would do that prior to shows. So we would have a sellout show of 18,000 people, and so a local group could be able to do kind of like a, they could say, hey, I opened for James Taylor or something like that. But we utilized a lot. Plus, we had art exhibitions. We created an art park as an entry to the amphitheater, and we immersed it with incredible art. As an outdoor gallery experience.
In addition to the Museum of Outdoor Arts, I know that you personally were involved with a listening lounge that you set up in Bowers and outside of Denver. A lot of that, I think, is also the approach, and what I've learned about that listening lounge is getting music outside of the kind of traditional setting, getting it more into what people experience every single day. Does that feed into your philosophy on how fine arts are approached?
Yes, the arts, all the arts, performing arts, the visual arts, writers, actors, I see the arts as positive change agents. I mean, they really are. The arts have always uplifted areas. I mean, you go into any city, Soho in New York started that way. I mean, it's a horrible part of the island. And the arts move in, and within, you know, several years, it becomes the hottest place. And that happens everywhere. Happens throughout the United States. So the cultural center here in FIM, we obviously want it to be that place. We want it to be the uplifting area, the support of the revitalization and the growth of Flint and the whole Genesee County.
As you're speaking about, you know, uplifting Flint, I'm thinking about Mayor Karen Weaver and her recent State of the City address. And we, you know, we had Mayor Weaver on Current State, and she was asked by Mark Bayshore how the people of Flint currently are amidst the news of the past few years. And she said, hopeful but frustrated because of all of that. And as you talk about the Flint Cultural Center, that seems to be one of the things to be hopeful about. So have you been in touch with Mayor Weaver or any other civic leaders of Flint about how the FIM, the Flint Institute of Music, can play a role moving forward?
As far as the mayor or the city council and the wards, we've reached out to them. It's my fourth day. But yes, and then, of course, all the cultural center. Absolutely, I want to have a dialogue, an open dialogue, because we want to do our part. I mean, the arts, and actually the whole county, the citizenry, what struck me the most when I first came to Flint was the support of, not only the support of the arts, but the depth and the breadth of the facilities. I mean, these are world-class facilities, all in one central area. City planners now are scrambling to trying to create the synergism that was already here. The foresight of the founding fathers to have this cultural center that has not only the Whiting, you have the planetarium, you have the theater groups. It's phenomenal, and the facilities are better than cities four times the size. So we're very fortunate as citizens in this area to have these facilities, and now we need to really just make sure that they are utilized to their best and fullest to help, again, be part of the revitalization of the whole area.
We're speaking with a new CEO of the Flint Institute of Music, Rodney Lontine, who's just started. August 1st was your first day. You're coming into the Flint Institute of Music at a very kind of celebratory period. It's the 35th anniversary of the Flint Youth Ballet, the 60th of the Flint Youth Theater, and the landmark 100th of the Flint Symphony Orchestra. That's a lot of landmarks that you're hitting right off the bat.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, we're excited about the 100th anniversary of the symphony. I mean, that's a real huge milestone. We plan on doing a great celebration for that. But all the the youth, the theater groups. But my philosophy is that we've had years and years, 100 years, obviously, of success with the symphony and all the other programs, is really to honor the history of where we've been, but with our eyes forward towards, how are we going to make these programs bigger, better, and greater. I mean, building on that success. So for each of the programming, be it the music school or the youth theater programs, the symphony, or outreach, that's going to be a big part of as we move forward, is really taking our programs and trying to, not only can you come here and enjoy it, but also take it out specifically in areas that may or may not have either the opportunity or the wherewithal to take advantage of these types of things. So that's going to be a big push as well.
There's a big challenge, I think, also with dealing with the arts is, and I'm saying this also as a classical music host, which is the main part of what I do at WKAR, there's the history of being very kind of admittedly European-centric. And in a community as diverse as Flint, that produces a very interesting challenge. How do you branch out into the community when it may not be quite as representative in its long-term history?
Well, twofold. One, there's a classical music, which you brought up, is wonderful. I mean, unless you're exposed to it, or if you may not know that you love it until you love it. It's like good food. I mean, you put good food from somebody, they may not know what it is, or they just know they like it. And that's kind of like getting back to what we talked about, the Music Appreciation Society. It was really trying to let people know that this is great. But you also, it's like fine wine. There's a big difference between a $10 bottle of wine and a $150 bottle of wine, but it's the nuances and it's understanding. So we have to not only educate and expose people to classical music, and there's several ways you can do that. We have our ongoing programming that is wonderful. We have an incredible maestro and conductor, Enrique. We're very fortunate. But there's also other things that the orchestra can do. And we're looking, and we're going to go down that direction. I mean, it's really reaching out to other groups. I recently did something in Colorado with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra, where we actually put on a program where the symphony played the music of 50 Cent. And it was wonderful. I mean, you had the violins, dun, 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 dun. I mean, the orchestra loved it. The audience liked it. And I'm not saying that's something we're going to do here, but we're going to look at drawing people that may not otherwise come to the symphony, either through programming and or through education. The same with the theater and same with the education. And it's more of, again, with parents when they're looking at what do they do with their children. I mean, a lot of people go into sports, and there's some great benefits to sports. I was in sports and everything, but the same types of benefits, or even more so, can be done through music and through theater. I mean, the same teamwork, critical thinking, confidence building, responsibility. So it's another way of just showing parents there's another alternative that they may not have already just automatically said, that makes sense.
Rodney Lontine, the new CEO of the Flint Institute of Music, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you so much again. I appreciate your time, and I look forward.
Coming up on Current State, the richness of American music is celebrated in a number of museums across the country. Cleveland's got rock and roll. Nashville, of course, has country. But R&B, that is rhythm and blues, has no such iconic place to call home. Still, the Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame is coming to Dearborn next weekend to induct some big names in the industry. And its founder hopes to build a shrine in the hometown of Motown. Current State's Kevin Lavery takes us on a tour through the history of R&B. That's coming up after the break. Hi, I'm Brooke Allen in for Mark Bayshore, and over the years, new Americans arriving in Michigan have helped mitigate some of the negative effects of the state's economic downturn and the loss of population during the Great Recession. In 1990, Michigan's immigrant community represented less than 4% of the state's total population. By 2010, that had risen to nearly 6%. And between 2010 and 2014, Michigan's foreign-born population grew by an additional 60,000, which is almost twice as fast as the national average, making the state a standout from others in its attraction to new Americans. And recently, a report was released from the Partnership for the New American Economy called the Contributions of New Americans in Michigan. And it's a culmination of research, including data on the foreign-born population in the state from the years 2010 through 2014. And joining us this morning to discuss the study's findings is Karen Felipe. She's the deputy director of MONA, the Michigan Organization for New Americans. And MONA was established by Governor Snyder in 2014 to support immigration efforts for the state of Michigan. And hello, Karen, how are you?
Good morning, Brooke. I'm fine. How are you?
Good. So, Karen, explain for us how MONA supports immigration efforts in Michigan. What things do you do?
Sure. So the Michigan Office for New Americans, or MONA, as you mentioned, was established by Governor Snyder in early 2014 to support immigration efforts for the state. And what we do are things like we look for barriers or perceived barriers within state agencies that provide services to immigrants to try and help minimize or eliminate those barriers. We don't change programs or we don't change any requirements, but looking for, as I mentioned, any of those barriers that might be there. So, for example, the healthcare process. There was some issues with the computer system within the state on healthcare issues, and so we would work both with our immigrant service organization partners and our Department of Health and Human Services to try and mitigate some of those issues that they were seeing. We've also done things such as worked with our Michigan Department of Transportation to help clear up the signage in and around the Ambassador Bridge. When you're down in Detroit and going to get off on certain exits, there was one exit that wasn't very clearly marked that if you got off, you literally got onto the bridge to Canada. There was no turning around. There was no street to turn on. You'd go right onto the bridge.
I've been on that bridge.
Yeah, so our U.S. Customs and Border Protection would have to turn people around if they didn't mean to get off there. And so we worked with MDOT to have more clearer signage put up. So now when you're driving down near Detroit, you'll see Canadian flags, you'll see U.S. flags, you'll see signs that say no reentry to the U.S. or entry to Canada only, to try and make that a little bit clearer. And you're right. I mean, even those of us who've been born and raised in Michigan our whole lives, that was confusing. So we can only imagine what that would be like for those where English isn't your first language.
So MONA did not conduct this study. It was conducted also by the Partnership for a New American Economy. Can you tell us who they are?
Sure. The Partnership for New American Economy was started by Michael Bloomberg, and it is approximately 500 Republican, Democratic, and independent mayors and business leaders from around the country who support sensible immigration reform. And the partnership actually completed a report like this for each of the 50 states. And then they turned to some of their partners within the state. We've worked with the Partnership for New American Economy for the last few years on some of their other reports as well. They looked to their state partners to try and help launch the report within each state. So we worked with the partnership to get this information out both to the media, to our partners and our stakeholders. MONA works with a number of different stakeholders around the state, universities, nonprofits, economic development groups, state agencies, et cetera. So ethnic chambers, ethnic business organizations, our three state ethnic commissions. So we worked with all of those partners to spread the information on this report that talks about the contributions or the economic impacts that immigrants have on our state.
So not to get too bogged down in numbers, but some of the study's findings definitely worth a mention, like immigrants as entrepreneurs. So what does the study show us about that?
Sure. So when we look at our entrepreneurs, we've got over 30,000 immigrants in Michigan who are self-employed, and those immigrant-owned businesses generated over $608 million in business income in 2014, and immigrant-owned businesses employ over 150,000 folks within our state. And so we look, you know, our immigrant entrepreneurs definitely are job creators for both in small businesses as well as our larger businesses. When we look at some of those immigrant-owned businesses like a Masco or a Meijer, as well as your local potential convenience store, gas station, or restaurants, right? There's a whole host of different types of businesses that immigrant entrepreneurs own that employ our Michiganders.
So that means if there's businesses here that they're starting and owning, then that means that they're earning and spending money as well.
Correct. Yes. So when we look overall, and like you said, we won't talk too much about numbers. We'll look overall, though, at immigrant contributions in Michigan. So there are just under 650,000 Michigan residents who are foreign born. It's about 6 to 7% of our population, and immigrants in 2014 earned over $19.5 billion, and $1.5 billion of that went to state and local taxes. Obviously, there was an amount that went to federal taxes, and that left about $14 billion in spending power for our immigrants to then, spend within our state. Be that buying a house, renting a house, consumer goods, just like we do, go out, right, buy clothes, go to the restaurants, etc.
So, is there a distinction made between documented and undocumented immigrants in this study?
Sure. So the report actually does a really good job, I think, of taking a whole bunch of different sectors, such as you mentioned entrepreneurs. It breaks down healthcare, agriculture, housing, international students, as well as the undocumented population. So it does talk specifically about the economic contribution of the we've got about 1% undocumented here in Michigan. And when we look again in 2014, some of the most recent data that's available to us, undocumented paid about $83 million in state and local taxes. So obviously that contributes to our economy as well.
So once again, I'm speaking with Karen Phillippe, Deputy Director of Michigan Office for New Americans, or MONA, about a recent study who looks at the impact of immigrants in Michigan. And Karen, I think you did just mention this, but some who argue against immigration do worry about undocumented immigrants who do not pay taxes. But you just said that's only 1%, correct? Or did I misunderstand?
Well, we have approximately 1% of our population, the state's population, of approximately 1% are undocumented, or about just over 125,000 people, about 126,398 are the estimated number of undocumented immigrants in Michigan. But when we do look at that population, as I mentioned, they actually did pay in 2014, the most recent data that we have from the report, they paid $82.9 million in state and local taxes.
And remind us what Governor Snyder's stance on immigration is.
Sure. So Governor Snyder is pro-immigration. We are very fortunate here in the state of Michigan to have Governor Snyder as our leader, in particular when it comes to immigration and making Michigan a more welcoming state for immigrants. The governor did come out a couple of years ago when the Senate passed comprehensive immigration reform. The governor did come out in support of comprehensive immigration reform.
And real quick, what about the argument that immigrants take jobs away from American-born workers, specifically poor or unskilled workers? Did this study shed any light on that issue?
So we look at jobs, skills overall. When you look at jobs within our agricultural industry or within our restaurant industry and all the way up into our, professional jobs, engineering, healthcare, et cetera. And statistics show that there are foreign-born at the higher end of the spectrum who have a master's or PhD, master's or higher degree, I should say, in a STEM field. Those foreign-born actually create a little over 2.5 jobs for U.S.-born. And when we look to some of the quote-unquote lower-skilled jobs, Bingo, our director, and I, we really try to stress that each job requires its own skill set, not necessarily low or high. But you've got individuals filling jobs that sometimes there are others that don't necessarily want to do those jobs, but they're definitely out there. So if we've got individuals who would like to work in the agricultural industry, there's lots of opportunities there, all the way from harvesting up to crop, processing, as well as looking up a little bit further up the chain in terms of like agricultural scientist type jobs.
Well, thank you so much, Karen, for joining us. I appreciate it. Again, that was Karen Philippi, Deputy Director of Michigan Office for New Americans, or MONA, shedding light on a new study that was just done.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you. And it was 39 years ago this week, August 16th, 1977, when the world was shocked by the death of Elvis Presley. And though Elvis was dubbed the king of rock and roll, his musical roots came from another great American genre, rhythm and blues. And last year, Elvis Presley was inducted into the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame. Now, the ceremony is coming to Dearborn this weekend to honor its next round of inductees. And current state's Kevin Lavery has been spinning those old 45s for a few days to get into the mood, Kevin. And where does one exactly find the R&B Hall of Fame?
Well, Brooke, right now, nowhere. The organization has been around since 2010 and has held several induction ceremonies, but it still has no permanent museum to call its home. Its founder, Lamont Robinson, is hoping to build it in Detroit. This year's event will be held next Sunday in Dearborn. It features about a dozen artists, including Prince, whom we just sadly lost in April. So I asked Lamont Robinson why he feels R&B deserves its own monument.
You know, rhythm and blues is probably the most popular sample of music and artists in the world. And rhythm and blues artists are the only artists that don't have a Hall of Fame. You know, country has one, rock has one, bluegrass, jazz, therefore and so on. So in 2009, I started going around the country wondering how do museums run and why do they bleed red ink? I wanted to make sure if I put something together, it was going to be put together right. And in putting it together, it took me about 2 years. I visited museums and found out that they had to be highly interactive, virtual reality, and they just couldn't be pictures on the wall and showcases, else we'd be out of business in 6 months. I better knock
on wood. Lamont Robinson grew up in suburban Cleveland. By the time he began to think of enshrining rhythm and blues alongside the other great American genres, his hometown was already well established as the site of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Still, Robinson chose Cleveland as the venue for the R&B Music Hall of Fame's first induction ceremony in 2013. It was a large class of 25 artists that included Otis Redding, The Temptations, and James Brown. The inaugural event was a hit. Soon, Robinson's phone was ringing with offers from promoters from across the country looking to land his next Rhythm and Blues review. In 2014, the ceremony was held in Football Hall of Fame city, Canton, Ohio. The next year, actor Morgan Freeman invited Robinson and company down to the Delta. In June 2015, the R&B induction came to Clarksdale, Mississippi. I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. Still, Robinson's vision had no place to call home. About a year ago, the crossroads took Lamont Robinson back up north. He moved to Detroit, where he hosted a second 2015 induction ceremony in October. The offers are still coming in from places like Chicago and Philadelphia, but Robinson wants to put down roots in the hometown of Motown.
We really hope that it happens here in Detroit. We're going to knock on some more doors and see if we can sit down with the mayor here in Detroit and see if we can get him in to just help us to build this. But outside of that, we have this great induction ceremony coming up on Sunday. And, you know, from Dionne Warwick to Smokey Robinson will be inducted, and they all support this effort that we're putting together.
So you have done everything you need to do to become just as legitimate as Cleveland and Nashville. The only thing you're lacking now is you're looking for a home. Everything else is pretty much complete then.
Everything that we have, the drawings, we have the people behind us. And, you know, I like to educate the people. Two things. One, a lot of people here, it took me about a year and a half to educate the people that Motown is not the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame. Motown is for those that were on that label. I think it's the greatest record label in the world, with the greatest artists. But a lot of people was thinking that was the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame. Then down in Memphis, got Stax. Those are just for those artists. We're talking about all-inclusive, bringing the whole history from radio personalities, TV personalities, you know, this is not just for African Americans. People like Dick Clark that helped propel African Americans in the music. Also Ed Sullivan. You know, you had a lot of non-African Americans that were forces in rhythm and blues music.
At the helm of the organization is Executive Director Cheryl Ruffin, the daughter of the late Temptations frontman David Ruffin. The board reviews nominees each year. Robinson says its criteria is more liberal than that of other halls of fame, so that more inductees can revel in their honor during their lifetimes.
You have to have made a record 20 years prior to being inducted. You don't have to have major, major hits. People that have been in the industry 40 years and maybe had a turntable hit, which is just a local hit, or maybe had a national hit, maybe just had one, but they've been in the business 40 years. We just can't throw that away. You won't get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with one hit. That's where we're a little different, is that we look at those that didn't have the big hits, but add it to the fabric of this thing called rhythm and blues music.
Well, I would say that you do have a lot of people on your list who did have some pretty significant hits. About the only artist that I didn't immediately recognize was Betty LaVette, but now that I've looked her up a little bit, I have heard her voice.
Let me down easy, for your love for me is gone. Let me down easy, since you feel to stay is wrong. I know it's all over, but the last goodbye.
We're talking with Lamont Robinson, the founder of the Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame. The organization is hosting its 2016 induction ceremony on August 21st in Dearborn. Two of the artists are now deceased. You've got Jimi Hendrix and Prince. Jimi Hendrix has been dead for almost 46 years, Prince for 4 months. In fact, when Prince was becoming a star, there were some comparisons between him and Jimi Hendrix. So you've got Purple Haze and Purple Rain covered in this event.
And then we've got Bootsy Collins, who is the funk master, who was good friends with Prince and idolized Jimi Hendrix.
Do you have a personal favorite, or is that kind of a loaded question? I know they're all great artists. Is there one who stands out?
I would have to say Smokey Robinson. Ooh, Baby, Baby is probably my favorite song. Smokey is one of the greatest tenors ever. Dionne Warwick, Walk On By.
Walk on by. Walk on by. Make me.
The Supremes, the last song that they were all together, Someday We'll Be Together. Those have to be my three favorite personal songs that I really like.
Kathy Hughes, the founder of Radio One, is one of your inductees and is also receiving a Music Living Legends Award. That made me think of the format that she pioneered, the Quiet Storm format in the 70s, and that was a Smokey Robinson single.
Wow, you did your homework.
Soft and warm, a quiet storm.
To get Kathy Hughes quiet in here, one phone call she was on, and we're also, she doesn't know this though, I hope she's not listening. We're going to be honoring her mother. Her mother was part of a famous band called the Sweethearts of Rhythm, which was an all-girl band back in the 40s. So we're going to surprise her and induct Sweethearts of Rhythm and her mother on that day. So we're going to have a lot of fun.
Lamont Robinson is the founder of the Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame.
The organization is conducting its fifth induction ceremony in Dearborn on the 21st that includes such artists as Smokey Robinson, Bootsy Collins, Dionne Warwick, Eddie Floyd, and Fats Domino. Thank you so much for talking with me, and this sounds like a terrific event.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Labry.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Lansing's alternative newspaper, The City Pulse, turns 15 years old this week with a special issue hitting newsstands on Wednesday. We talk with publisher Burl Schwartz about his vision for the paper and what lies ahead. Plus, Michigan blessed with a lot of water, but how exactly do we use all of it? MLive reporter Garrett Ellison recently took a deep dive into Michigan water use data and made some interesting discoveries. He'll share what he learned in our weekly environmental segment. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. And thanks also to Mark Bayshore, Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Brooke Allen. In for Mark Bayshore, you've been listening to Current State on WKAR, and we will see you tomorrow.